This is HPR episode 2052 entitled, A Nerdy Conversation with Lyndon About Technology. It is hosted by Sigflup and is about 40 minutes long. The summary is, in this episode of HPR, Sigflup interviews Lyndon, who specializes in databases.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
I'm here with our friend Lyndon, who works with computers, databases specifically, from what I understand.
Yep.
And, welcome. What exactly do you do with databases?
I have no idea.
What do you think you do?
I primarily work with scientists who have data that they've collected in various ways out in the field, as scientists do, and this data is in all sorts of different messy formats, and a lot of it has a visual component, like camera images or satellite images, and then metadata about that. And I get spreadsheets, I get hard drives full of pictures, I get all this mess, and then my job is to turn it into a database
available
on the browser. It's like I get paid to make things nice and neat and orderly and not useless.
Yeah.
It's great.
That does sound pretty good. I ask everyone this. How did you get into computers in the first place?
My dad was an electronic engineer. He's a big inspiration because he has a associate's degree and just kind of managed to teach himself enough that now he's doing things that the rest of his colleagues have at least masters, and but he's very very humble about it. And so my favorite story is that he decided I was playing too much Tetris and other like DOS games. And so he hid my games folder. And so I had to learn the DOS, basically command line or whatever it was.
It was a hidden.
And find it.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And so then he came back like half an hour later and there I was playing Tetris.
Yeah, that's funny.
And then I kind of didn't end up having that, like, starting playing with computers when you're little and then being a 14-year-old whiz.
Yeah.
Because
it's a lot of people who don't have that experience.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a cliche.
Yeah. And I started when I was really young and then I kind of fell out of it for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
Until I decided what I kind of wanted to do for a career. And then that ended up needing computer stuff. And then I got hooked again.
Yep, that's how you get hooked again.
And I'm very glad I am. Yeah, I did.
So when you put together these databases, do you use SQL, Postgres, SQLite, anything like that?
Yeah, I'm mostly using MySQL Postgres SQL. When I'm doing a lot of times when I'm doing stuff that involves embedded systems and stuff that needs to talk to kind of a lightweight database, I use SQLite.
I see. So you also do embedded systems of some sort?
Yeah. So I've worked with a lot of different remote sensing applications.
Cool.
Especially those that use visual data stuff. A lot of camera traps.
That's awesome.
I'm working on this project that has camera traps in the Serengeti.
Really?
That take pictures of, like, I'm looking at these pictures and all of a sudden there's giraffe knees. The giraffe walked past, or glowing eyes that I have no idea what it is.
Right.
So some of these are like surveillance cameras that have a little embedded Linux operating system.
BusyBox or something like that.
BusyBox.
From my experience with security cams, a lot of them are BusyBox.
The ones that I like the most have something Linux on them, but it's basically a tiny Linux.
Something OS. Linux. What could this be?
I want to write a distro now.
Something Linux. Yes! That's perfect. What do you run? Something Linux. Speaking of Linux, you just installed Arch, from what I hear.
I did. I had my fancy new computer stopped working, so I had to resurrect a non-fancy old ThinkPad Edge.
Yes.
And I keep a list of stuff that I want to play with. And Arch Linux was the next distro on
it. It's kind of cool to have a list of things to play with.
And it grows way faster than I will ever get through them.
Yeah.
And it ranges everywhere from, a temperature sensor for my toaster oven, because it sets off the fire alarm a lot.
Yeah.
To playing with data from the Large Hadron Collider.
Yes.
And also OSs.
So how do you feel about this whole Internet of Things that people are talking about?
Like anything, it's both buzzwordy. And I should know, as somebody whose job could be described as a data scientist.
Yeah.
Which is not my favorite phrase ever, but
really?
It sounds cool.
It does sound cool.
But
it sounds like the data does what you want it to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I do kind of research data, or like mess around with it in the way that is a very scientifically based thing. But I think that a lot of the stuff coming out of that falls under the label of Internet of Things tends to come from the sort of classic Silicon Valley venture funding startup sort of thing, where it seems like a lot of the applications are solutions in search of a problem.
Yeah.
And then also a good heavy dose of this gizmo is cool. Well,
yeah.
What does it do? What problems does it solve?
It does cool things.
It's cool.
Yeah.
Which there's a place for, but there's also a lot of cool stuff that people have developed that are coming into their own now, because this networking technology is maturing, especially in areas like helping the elderly and disabled stay in their homes.
Okay.
So there's a, I wish I could remember who's doing it, but somebody's developed a mat that sits on the kitchen floor.
Yes.
And so when somebody comes into the kitchen in the morning, it non-invasively can take some of the measurements, like weight and that kind of thing.
Huh.
And
that's really clever.
And update basically a little checkup. And then a doctor can look at that over time and see, instead of the person going in every 3 months. And it's harder to get that kind of information.
That's cool.
So and then, of course, there's all that security and privacy.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Ethical when you're, stuff, but
when your milk carton talks to your box of cereal, and says one of us has to get replenished.
Yeah, like, I'm not real fond of a lot of that, but
I am not either. I think it will push security though.
Yeah,
so that could be a good thing.
I built a RFID reader a number of years ago, and it doesn't work anymore.
Oh, did you build the actual inductor and everything like that, or did you?
I got a commercial RFID reader that didn't work for my purposes, and that I had to hack a lot to make it actually work.
Sweet.
And then I broke it almost as soon as I made it, of course.
Yes, we all know about that.
But because the technology has advanced, it wouldn't work anymore. And a large chunk of that is security, which is good.
Yeah.
But I think that there's a lot of really awesome ways that the Internet of Things concept could help people.
Yeah.
But
we're getting to this. I think it started with the cloud, and I have the Internet of Things, and you have exploits like.
This is also vague. It's somewhere in the cloud.
Somewhere in the cloud, yeah.
There's things in the cloud, and and they talk to each other.
There's a top-level domain, that cloud, and so we should search for things in the cloud.
Things in the cloud. Yeah,
before we continue with this. I'm kidding. I'll probably do that immediately afterwards. And you all are on delay, aren't you? If this were live, you could beat us.
And what's funny is that, like, I'm working with a scientist at the University of Minnesota.
Yeah.
And their database is hosted by the University Supercomputing Institute.
Okay.
And so I spent hours. It was great. I was sitting in a coffee shop, hooked up through the VPN to the supercomputers.
Yes, that sounds awesome.
So awesome, because it's like the way that networking started.
Yeah,
was
exactly.
Dummy terminals attached to supercomputers, and here I am on my Chromebook, basically using it as a terminal.
Yeah.
But I'm very comfortably in a coffee shop, and of course, what am I doing? I'm reading very large text files using less. With my great power.
Yeah.
But the people that I talk to about this database, it's in the cloud.
Yeah.
Well, it's hosted at MSI. It's a very specific, like, the supercomputer that it's hosted.
So you have the code there.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. I can do all sorts of
very
ethical and
non-ethical things.
Very ethical and things with it entirely within the University of Minnesota's security and user agreements.
Cool.
Totally.
So
very powerful statistics.
Rumor has that the computers, when they're not working, do what you tell them to do.
When they're not working?
Yeah. Do you remember that you were just telling me about how?
So my Chromebook doesn't work very well anymore because it's all of 8 months old, and that's just ancient.
Boom. Yeah.
But when I really need it to, and I give it that look that I learned when I was five from watching original series, Star Trek and Spock, look.
Yeah.
And, and it usually shapes up pretty fast, which tends to both impress and intimidate people.
Yeah, yeah. I love the fact that Kirk could make a computer explode just by talking to it.
Yep.
I think that was pretty awesome.
Yep. Definitely.
So you have a pile. Opposite. You have a pile of technology.
I have several piles of technology of various sorts. Which one in specific?
One that contains the TRS-80.
Oh, yeah, my amazing laptop museum.
Yeah.
I should, like, make a little
I would
circus theme song. Amazing laptop museum. Yeah. Come see the incredible Trash 80.
Yes. Behold the laptop with two screens, only built with the one screen.
I don't even know what it is, but it's chunky, it's white, and the actual screen, available screen area is about half of the size of the lid of the laptop.
Oh, geez. So this is a laptop.
It's supposedly a laptop. It's
like a 386 or something like that?
You know, I would have to look at it, but it's, I thought the screen was so big.
Yes.
I could do all sorts of
awesome things. I got my first TFT display laptop. Oh my god, it was so amazing. I remember it was like looking at a monitor. It was great. It was great. What's it?
But I know that the Trash 80 is in the bottom.
Yeah.
I don't know what mysterious varieties of things live above it. But yeah. When I needed to resurrect this ThinkPad Edge, I just picked it off the top and ran with it.
All right, cool.
And I also know that the packing material is floppy disks and
did you say the packing manual material?
Yeah, around the hold, because the box is a little bigger than the contents. So I shoved floppy disks around it and
what are manuals these floppy disks for manuals?
Who knows?
Yeah,
it might just be like, I don't know, a like Windows 95 install thing on 10 floppy disks.
So you've been on BBSs before?
Yeah, when I was like tiny.
Yeah.
And probably not nearly old enough to talk to the people I was talking to.
Yes. Did you visit? Oh, you were in Seattle.
I was in Seattle.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be completely different.
And just, I don't, I couldn't remember names.
Okay. It's okay.
Stuff. But I do know there was a girl in some tiny town in Eastern Washington that I talked to a lot. And I actually ran into her at the Strange Loop conference, which is a very eclectic programming conference in St. Louis, who were amazing and gave me a diversity scholarship a couple of years ago.
That's awesome.
To attend, because I am very diverse. but I ran into this girl who we'd grown up together, and we were both really happy that the other one was still taking along in technology. And
yes, that's awesome.
That's kind of the power of that kind of thing.
Yep. That's cool. I think there's this narrative when it comes to computers, this sort of stereotype of people saying, oh, yeah, I had a computer back when I was 8 years old. I was programming in C, and it was great. Basic, rather. Mostly basic. Like, have you had that experience? Were you the sort of the early person with a computer, or... how exactly did getting a computer work out for you?
Yeah, I was, and then by, I don't know, middle school, I really fell out of it. And I wasn't doing much. Well, middle school is not great for many people in American educational the system, although there's always exceptions.
Yeah.
But also, I think, I don't know, I just didn't have a lot of peer reinforcement for that, and a lot of other stuff going on. And I do know that in high school, I tried to get involved in the robotics club.
Yeah.
And kind of got pushed out of that by the robotics clique.
Yeah, the robotics clique.
But I always wanted to be a biologist.
Yeah.
And so when I got to college, I was very, very fortunate to, and completely unexpectedly, I expected to go to the same state school as my entire family.
Yeah.
I got to go to a women's college in... Massachusetts, Mount Holyoke, and they had a very strong and very
sweet,
very well run computer science department.
Yeah, that's what.
And with a great legacy of supporting women in computer science,
and it's really important.
Both sort of providing a safe space that we weren't exposed to a lot of the things that that women decide they just don't want to deal with the shit from the environment.
Yes.
And while also giving us a lot of the skills to withstand that once we got out into the tech world.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And we had a lot of really cool projects there, and that sort of wakened this latent interest.
Giant, yeah.
And then also I wanted to be a biologist, and most scientists today are self-taught in R, in Python, in databases, because they need to be. And so people who can either learn that quickly or teach other people or have that background really have an advantage.
Yes.
So that kind of both necessity and passion combined to get me to the point where I can make a living off of databases and make not a hobby, but I spend a lot of my free time doing cool stuff on the computer too.
Yeah.
So
that's rad. I remember kind of going back to grade school, or middle school rather. I wasn't taught programming in school, just not at all. Mm-hmm. It was all me with my Atari ST. And I remember I got detention, and they're like, just go to the library and hang out for a while. That was about my detention. And so I found this computer, and I found Logo on it.
Oh.
And I'm thinking, like, these computers have Logo on them. Why aren't we being taught Logo? Like, it's, I don't know, it kind of made me a little bit upset.
I remember teaching myself Boolean logic.
Yes.
In elementary school, because the interface to the Seattle Public Schools library computer, like whatever it was, you could search for books using Boolean logic.
That's
and
cool.
I just sat there and figured out, like, and or not.
Yes.
So, and just by plugging things in and seeing what it gave me.
That's cool. That's
and
cool
then I taught all of the rest of the third grade or whatever how to do Boolean logic. But that was never, that wasn't what we were learning in math.
Yeah.
Ever.
I see.
I didn't have that formally until literally discrete math in college.
I see. The, I remember before I got on the internet through CompuServe, we were a CompuServe family. What, before I continue, like, how did you first get online?
I have no idea, but my dad had some modem rigged up. I don't think we ever used it, but I do remember having somewhere in some box.
Yeah.
One of those, early, phone handset couplers.
Yes.
That you would literally, like, suction cup to the phone.
I'm leaving right now. Here, I'm going into my room.
And there's banging behind the door.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
And I'm narrating you going into your room and banging around. And coming out with, oh my gosh. Yeah!
It's key shifting.
For telephone communication, indirect connect, press spacebar. Oh my gosh.
We have
so
a phone line here.
Ours had a separate thing that you like actually connected, you put onto the headset.
Okay.
And then it was connected to the device.
Sweet.
I have an issue where I don't remember
models
like,
and stuff.
I don't
like
remember
that.
Models, I don't remember company names.
Yeah.
I called if you asked me about like old computer systems, at one point I called it a Dex VAD instead of a Dex
VAX. Yeah, that's funny.
So I couldn't tell you what we had, but that's like exactly.
But you had a Dex VAX?
No, I'm sorry. One of the gizmos to connect. Via the phone handset.
I see.
But.
Oh, was going to ask you.
That modem noise is embedded in my memory.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful noise.
Yeah. I wonder how many geeks have that as their ringtone.
Yeah.
I should get on that.
I have a person dialing as my ringtone. It kind of confuses people.
Yeah.
So
my partner has the X-Files theme song.
Oh, yeah?
And
it's pretty wicked.
Yeah.
Oh, shoot, I was going to ask you something.
Damn it.
Oh, my God.
Well, I can talk about my pet topic that I always try to push whenever I can.
So I hear that you have something that you, like a topic, your pet topic that you like to push.
Yeah, I do. And that pet topic is citizen science. Da-da-da-da.
All right.
And the concept of citizen science is that there are some things that humans are really good at that computers aren't.
Yes.
But in science, there aren't enough grad students to chain in the basement and make them slave away for 80 hours a week to do all this stuff.
Yes.
So give the grad students a break and go look up citizen science projects like Zooniverse, which is like the word zoo, Z-O-O-N-I-V-E-R-S-E.
Okay.
And this is a project that lets scientists put data, mostly visual data, things like these camera traps or pictures of plankton, or originally it was pictures of galaxies, where computers are actually not that good at identifying what kind of a galaxy.
I imagine not.
Whether it's a globular cluster or a spiral or whatever.
A great problem with computer science is you can't figure out what a cat and a dog looks like. You can't distinguish the two.
Right. Humans' brains are optimized for pattern recognition.
Oh, yeah.
And computers, we haven't really gotten there, which is why, like, CAPTCHAs work.
Yep.
And actually, ReCAPTCHA is a citizen science project where a lot of it has historically been used to digitize books and other data.
Okay.
But Zooniverse, so it's different kinds of basically pattern recognition tasks. And it also kind of hooks into the same part of your brain as like little clicking flash games. So it's really fun to spend a couple hours like identifying there are two lions eating a gazelle.
That's cool.
In this picture, or there are three wildebeest, and holy crap, I have no idea what that critter is, but it's big. And that specific project is one that I work on called Snapshot Serengeti. And it's just, it's really cool stuff, and it really does help researchers figure out what's going on in the natural world, which it can impact conservation in Africa or climate science in the US or and I think it's a really cool way for people to get involved with science in a fairly easy way. And I think the tech behind it is pretty cool too. But I'm biased.
Cool. That's pretty rad. I forget who it is, but someone has this theory of artificial intelligence where you have a hierarchy of neurons.
Mm-hmm.
Each neuron can predict a little bit, like, oh, I'll be on if on is on when I'm on or something like that. And so it's this hierarchy of memory where the top... The top neurons. Thank you. Contain neural information cluster. Like if it's on, you're talking about Bill Clinton. If it's off, you're talking about Hillary Clinton. I don't know. It's an interesting.
And if it explodes, you're talking about Trump.
If it explodes, you're talking about Trump. As things tend to explode, Trump. Jesus fucking Christ! You're a mean one, Mr. Trump.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Instead of the
Emacs versus VI religion here, we're going to talk politics.
Them.
by the way. Bim is the answer to that.
All right, cool. Me too.
Which just, I wish I had some sort of like deep philosophical reason, but really it's just what my Professor Barbara Lerner, it's all your fault. My mentor in college.
I see. I started because Bim was the only BI was the only editor. Like, you have a RAM disk of an installation media for OpenBSD. Like, BI is there. Mm-hmm. And I think it's there. If it's not there, Ed is there. But yeah, it's Bim for me.
It's just what I... At some point, something I've learned getting older that's weird is that you do end up specializing a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
And I've learned, especially as a freelancer, this is my little old wise freelancer advice, is that it's really important to say, no, I'm not interested in that to stuff. So I do not do JavaScript.
Oh, yeah?
I can, if you give me some JavaScript, I can... Like
can read
I'll
it at least.
Maybe vomit a little, but I can.
You know what the JavaScript just, does. If you don't have a semicolon, it stops the parser, it goes back a little bit, and adds a semicolon. So it'll like insert a semicolons for you.
That's kind of neat.
Yeah, I don't know.
And it does some awesome stuff. And I know that nobody really uses raw JavaScript because there's
I do.
So much. Well,
I like it.
Oh,
I love JavaScript.
Okay, I'm done with this interview. I'm done talking. No, but you know,
we're gonna get married. I just thought I should tell you that.
Uh-oh.
All right, this conversation's getting a little bit weird.
Yeah, off into the alternative future.
Yeah,
you know, when the theory of alternate or what are those called, points where universes separate, like decision points. Now I'm getting into like quantum theory.
I don't know,
but there's one universe in which I storm out of the house right now, and
the many universe theory.
Yeah,
multiverses.
Well, that's because that's the thing, is that I don't do JavaScript, but I can give you the name of half a dozen awesome developers who can do that for you. It's just not
something you like.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with me.
Important.
For something, I don't know, like interpretive languages, I don't really use that much. I heard you really like interpretive languages.
Yeah, well, once I was introduced to the Java
runtime environment,
That made my life 10 times easier.
See, you see,
I mostly work in Python, which is just pleasant. It's just nice. It's like a comfy couch.
Okay.
You can read it easily. You can read the laziest programmer's crap code. And the other thing I use a lot is Perl, which you
can not read. Yeah.
But it's really good for its applications.
Yeah.
And then the third language I write in the most is R.
R?
Which is, it's a open source statistics language that's based off of S.
I see.
And it's used extensively by scientists.
Cool.
Because it's the first language of many scientists, which causes a lot of problems because in R... the data structures are excellent. It's really good for if you're trying to get a spreadsheet into an actually usable form. So I use it a lot when I'm building databases, but indices start at one.
Okay.
So you try to turn a self-taught R programmer, into a fully fledged, programmer developer who can do a wide range of things.
Yeah.
And once they're able to
do all sorts of things, and they keep getting index out of bounds errors because they can't grok this whole starting at zero thing.
I see.
It causes many problems.
I imagine that would cause a lot of problems.
Don't know why that it does that. But yeah, interpreted languages. I like writing scripts. I don't actually write right now. I don't really write a lot of sort of full-fledged applications.
I was thinking about one thing, you know, gorillas.bass. The gorillas. It's a basic, QBasic program. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, these two gorillas, and they're in a city.
Vague concept of this.
I'm like, hey, thing. I don't really have QBasic on my OpenBSD or Linux machine, but it would be cool to write a basic interpreter and then try and play it on top of that. I think that would be a fun project.
I got confused for a second because I use a program called Cubase.
Oh, use Cubase.
Which is audio.
Yep. Yeah. My dad was, that's the reason why we had an Atari ST, because by that my father liked to do musical stuff, and so you like, it has a MIDI interface to it.
Right.
And so that was the reason why we had it.
Yeah, I had a MIDI keyboard that somebody bought me so I could learn how to play the piano.
Cool.
And it had this program that came along with it that was a learning how to play piano program.
Yeah.
And it had these little this little game where if you hit the note, instead of notes, there were ducks flying across the screen. And if you hit the right note, the duck quacked and disappeared.
Hmm.
And so I never really got it working, but I wanted to extract the MIDI file for the quack. Okay. So I could turn the quacks into a on my keyboard and play things entirely in quacks.
That's good.
That was my first encounter with MIDI.
Yeah. Mine was a Roland DS1, which is a pretty cool keyboard, I suppose. But I had a that was my first experience with MIDI.
Somebody tried to sell me one of those, not
really,
actually, all that long ago.
Hey, do you want to see my DSS1?
I'm getting to learn look and of. Hey, you want to see my crazy old technology?
Yeah,
there's this disc sitting over there, and the
little
coupler.
You narrate while I go inside and get it.
And now she's going to disappear back behind the door. And see how much banging and
it's too heavy.
Oh,
it'd be too heavy.
That's okay.
This is how I socialize.
That's pretty much what I do too. Except that would involve more going down to the storage unit and hanging around.
No storage units here.
And stuff.
All right. Do you want to? Can conclude the presentation, the interview. Do you have a Twitter account or an email account or any way you can get you?
I'm on Twitter a lot. It's at Tesherista, which is TESHERISTA.
Okay.
And I am building up things under the handle Linden more.
Okay. Now.
Yeah, I don't have a website right now because
you don't like JavaScript.
I don't like JavaScript.
I'm kidding.
That's as good of an excuse as I have. All actually, right. No, it's because I'm rebuilding a WordPress framework and using my own website as a. Which I realize is kind of dumb, but I'm too far in now to
give up. Yes, I know how that's like.
All right. Well, thank you. We'll keep in touch.
Yeah,
and absolutely. Take care.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.